Welcome Kristen Benson back, and her topic this morning, I almost said this afternoon, it can't be that confused, is supporting gender creative children, and I know we're going to learn a lot. Thank you, Kristen.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's lots of familiar faces, so that's fun. Welcome back. Those of you who are here on Monday, I think we had a really nice conversation. Today, it's a little bit more structured because I'm talking about some specific projects. At the same time, I really value dialogue. And so please interrupt, ask questions, make comments. Like, I'd love for this to stay interactive, and I don't assume that I have all of the knowing in the room. Like, all of you bring ideas and thoughts, and so I'd really, this is a place where we come together with those ideas, so please don't hesitate to jump in at any point. How many folks were not here on Monday or anywhere? Okay. All right, so four. So we'll still do introductions. So some of you, I'm sorry, you're going to do it again. But that's okay, because we all get to know each other. I tend to do an agenda. So here's what I have on the agenda for our time together. And we'll see how far we get, because this is a topic that we could probably sit here all day and continue to talk about different facets of how, what to, yeah, how to support, what are the issues. So I'm going to do my best job to be concise and also have time for us to talk. And then touch a little bit on what some of the existing research says about trans and gender creative kids and families. Talk some about what the research says about family acceptance. And then talk about a project that I conducted and some of the findings there where I interviewed parents. So does that sound okay to everyone? Anything that you're hoping to get that isn't on the agenda that you'd like us to add to the agenda? Okay, well, that's flexible. If you change your mind halfway through, let me know. Okay, as Sharon introduced, I even used my good handy-dandy academic PowerPoint slide while I can. As I mentioned before, I'm at North Dakota State. I'm en route to Appalachian State in North Carolina. And I didn't say this last time. I said it to a couple of folks, but I got into this particular area of research. I'm a family therapist. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I was in my doctoral program, and Virginia Tech was offering a new graduate certificate in women and gender studies, and I took a gender theory course. And it kind of, I sat there kind of stunned as we talked about specific populations, like kids with intersex conditions, trans issues, and I went, how come I'm about to finish a doctoral degree in clinical work, and we've never once in one of my classes talked about how to support these folks? What do you do if a mom comes in and says, my kid just told me he wants to wake up tomorrow, girl, and I don't know what to do? Like, I had no training on how to engage in those conversations with parents. And that, I went back to my dissertation chair and said, I think I need to change my topic. And that was a shift, and that was 13 or 14 years ago. And things at that point, we weren't really talking about gender identity very much, and a lot has changed in that time, and at the same time, a lot has stayed the same. So thank you all for being here, but that's a little bit about me. So I'm currently in Fargo, North Dakota, but if you try to contact me come August 1st, I will be in Boone, North Carolina. All right, so we'll start. I want to just do language. So I kind of just brainstormed and threw things up here, and I'm going to use your some of the words interchangeably. So transgender, when we talk about transgender folks, we're talking about people, or I'm referring to people who were assigned male or female at birth based on their bodily attributes. You know, the baby is born, the doctor says it's a girl, it's a boy, based on their genitals or their hormones or chromosomes. And so folks who are trans, when we're referring to trans people, it's people who identify with a gender that is not the sex that they were assigned at birth. So we're making a distinction between sex and gender, sex being more bodily attributes, gender being socially constructed categories about what it means to be feminine or masculine, and folks who identify outside of that. What I want to say about all of this language, it's not comprehensive, and it doesn't fit for all people. Language is very personal. Identity is personal. So each person, you might look at them and label them in your own mind as being similar or like, but they might have very different identities. these, and you don't know that until you engage in conversation. So not assuming is important, but it's also not assumed that you're supposed to know everybody's identity either. You know, grace plays a role in learning and getting to know people and in relationships. So I have these terms here for us to be thinking about, but also want to be very careful to say that we don't want to just assume that any of these words fit for any individual person that we might meet. I also, this is probably a good time for me to remind myself and say out loud, I don't speak on the behalf of groups of people that I'm not a part of. So I am not a trans, I'm a cisgender person. So when I say cisgender, that means the sex I was assigned at birth reflects the gender that I have come to identify with as I've grown up. As assigned girl, female, I identify as a woman. So therefore the word cis means same. And it's a word that we've started using more recently to have language to talk about privilege. I wouldn't necessarily say people identify as cisgender, because really it's language that we've developed so that we can talk about people who aren't trans and the kinds of privileges that they live with in the world, the kinds of things we don't have to deal with or think about. So we'll touch on that a bit. But for language, I'll go through just some of these things. Gender expansive, gender creative, gender fluid, gender queer. Those all reflect gender diversity and the idea that gender exists on a spectrum. And that people might be on closer to one end of the spectrum than the other. They might change over the course of time. It might reflect or experience your gender differently on an hour by hour, day to day basis. That gets really tough for other people who have been socialized in a very binary world that see sex and gender as being fixed. And only you are one or the other, and these are the rules of being one or the other. So I've talked to folks, even trans folks, who are comfortable with a trans identity. You are assigned male at birth, you identify as a woman. I'm okay with that. Not that we ever get to say what we're okay with for other people, but we'll just go there. I'm okay with that. But that other person who wears lipstick on some days and not on other days, why can't they just pick one? You know, so we still see, even within gender diverse communities, that there's some variation in terms of identity as well as inclusion politics and comfort. But this all comes out of a culture and being socialized to look at gender as being binary, and it's one or the other, and you can't really, never the two shall meet kind of deal, even though that's not true. Like, we all defy gender. Every single one of us, if we were to look at what are the strict rules of gender, every single one of us, if you are a woman and you wear pants and, you know, I mean, like there are rules that we all violate on a regular basis, and that's okay, right? So terms like transmasculine, transfeminine, they move away from a fixed gender, but reflect more of people's experiences with gender without saying I am a woman, but I identify in a more feminine way. So it's not, again, putting them into a fixed box, but allowing some fluidity and addressing attributes. And then there are just kids that are gonna say, I'm a boy. They're not gonna, I don't wanna use the word transgender. I don't wanna use the word gender creative. I'm just a boy. You might think I'm a girl, but I know I'm a boy, and that's it. So for some folks, they don't wanna use trans language at all. They just are who they are, and that's how they want to be seen in the world. And that's how they experience themselves in the world. So you can see there's quite a bit of variation with this language, and we're only on slide one, right? So I'll go back to my statement that identity is personal, and it can change over time. What's also important around language like gender expansive and gender creative, I tend to use that language to talk about children, especially pre-pubescent children, so that we're not putting labels that are sometimes diagnostic. While the word transgender is not a diagnosis, it tends to be associated sometimes with gender identity disorder, or it seems to be kind of a finite statement about somebody. And kids are developing. And some kids who are gender creative when they're little will grow up and say, I'm trans. Other kids won't. Some will grow up and say, I'm gender fluid. You know, children play with gender, and sometimes it means nothing. I think now that we're talking about gender identity in more public spaces, it's been interesting as a therapist, because I've had parents come in and say, you know, like, my kid talks about wanting to be a girl princess. And like, what does that mean? I'm like, it means they're in kindergarten and they're playing with princesses. It doesn't have to mean anything. Could it mean something? Maybe. But, you know, you let the kids play it out. Like, let's see where this goes. So I think that that's kind of the double-edged sword is it's great that we're more educated and we're learning more and we're actively engaged in social science research. But it also, it's been interesting to hear parents that kind of make that jump, like, oh, could this be happening? And then once you talk a little bit, probably not, but maybe. So I tend to, when I talk about kids, talk about gender creative and gender expansive to allow flexibility for different kinds of experiences.
Can you say a little bit more about gender queer?
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And the Q on the end of the LGBTQ.
Yeah, well, you know.
Whether or not it's used or not, or so.
That's a good question. And I think it depends who you ask as to how they're going to respond.
So I came to the West Coast several years ago, and there was a meeting for the LGBTQ community. And I said to him, did you know there was a Q? No, we didn't know what the Q stood for, because in Kansas City, there was no Q. And I'm very good friends with the head of our LGBT person at Hallmark. And I got back and I said, why didn't you ever tell me there was a Q? And he said, well, that's controversial. So I am very very questioning about the Q.
So we can start with queer and then we can talk about genderqueer. So I'm going to talk like an academic for a minute, and I fully embrace the word queer as an academic. When we think about queer theory, like if we compare queer theory to feminist theory helps us understand marginalization based on, like, gender-based marginalization. Queer theory helps us dismantle the categories of gender. And so when I talk about queerness and when I consider queerness, it's about opening up. It's not, it's sometimes referred to as an umbrella term. I do not refer to it. I don't use that language as an umbrella term to refer to anything that's LGBT. Like, Q just refers to everyone. I think Q, it's an identity. It's also a political statement that defies some of the boxes and the norms and these social standards. So for some people, when they then apply that to their gender. So people who have a queer identity, that can refer to sexual orientation, it could refer to gender identity. I sometimes get pegged or labeled as a lesbian, but I would say my personal identity would be a queer. And it keeps me out of boxes, and I think it allows for more flexibility in understanding other people's identities and who I might be attracted to and in relationship with. And so we can apply that or think about that in regards to people's gender identity as well. People don't necessarily want boxes and categories, or they don't fit, like, they don't believe that they fit in a box or a category. And again, this comes from my conversations with people. This could be different once you're talking to somebody who says, yeah, I'm genderqueer. If you ask them what it means to them, it might not be at all what I'm saying right now. So there's that.
So there's some ambiguity around it.
Well, with identity at all, you know, any language we use to reflect identity. But I like to use Q when I say LGBTQ because it does allow another element of inclusion. And I think it politicizes it sometimes. As we have seen more political action and inclusion for gay rights, to some set, I could go at this, could be a whole other conversation, but we see homonorming, and so now there's a way to be gay, which includes doing a lot of things that used to be straight, if that makes sense to folks. So, you know, as people have had access to marriage, now there's an expectation that couples get married, which has been really tough for people who have been together for 20 years and were never recognized by the government, and now they're saying, you have to tell me in order for my marriage to, I mean, my relationship to matter. I need this recognition from the government that didn't recognize our relationship for 20 years. I don't need that. So, That's just an example. It's a little bit of a tangent, but an example of sometimes the need to politicize and remember that all identity politics are political. People's experiences are political, and they're politicized. So an individual might not be political. A 10-year-old gender creative kid might be political, but if that child isn't politicized in our culture currently, I don't know who is. I mean, that is a child who is highly politicized in the way the politicians are talking, legislation is being discussed,
policies are happening in school systems. I mean, that kid's life is politicized even if that child themselves is not. So that's where I think, you know, including the Q is relevant and important. I'm going to go too much on a tangent there. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to follow up on Peg's question. Why would that be considered controversial to the LGBT group that didn't want Q? Why is queer
My own belief around that, and I don't know of this particular individual's, but queer has his history. Well, its original history, it was not a pejorative word, and then it was used as a slur. So there's also some generational, and this has come up at conferences I've been at, where there is, I think, a certain, there's a specific generation who heard that word referred to them in very pejorative, derogatory ways, and have no interest in reclaiming the language. And to me, that is even different from like the word homosexual, which we talked about. That was a word that was developed to institutionalize people. It has never had any kind of connotation other than that. It was a diagnostic term, right? Mm-hmm. That diagnosis was removed from the DSM. We don't diagnose people with homosexuality as a disorder anymore. Really, to continue using it is pretty pejorative. Queer is different because the origins of that language were not negative, right? It meant happy, it meant different, it meant non-normative, but it didn't mean bad. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the conversations, and I'm just sharing snippets of the conversation.
And I've also heard plus added to the end of that. Is that appropriate to say, like, LGBT?
I think it depends who you ask. The plus would be another effort to be inclusive of all of the language that isn't included in the LGBT. I would much rather see a plus. I don't like when I hear people refer to alphabet soup. I think I hear that sometimes. I'm just kind of like, ew. Maybe don't do that. But my own institution added a plus so that it just acknowledges that there are more and more, there's pansexual identities. There are more and more identities that are people are identifying with. And so it just allows for more openness and inclusion. Yeah. So this is we looked at this the other day, but I thought this was a great place for us to kind of center and remember. There we go. This definition of ally, which includes some advocacy thinking as well. But an ally is someone who recognizes that they are on the privileged side of a particular prejudice and or oppression divide created by society. The ally then actively engages in a search and implementation of strategies to dismantle that divide. And so I have an invitation for you all today. As we engage in our conversation, we're going the wrong way. Computer's smarter than I am. Okay, so my invitation for you all is that as we talk today, that you consider who or how you want to be as an ally or an advocate. Are we going to talk about topics perhaps that come up that you think, oh, this is relevant to a system I'm engaged in or work that I'm going to do? Some of you are already talking about, you know, you're thinking ahead as parents and as faith leaders and as teachers. Some of you already engaged or have been engaged in medical disciplines. We're going to talk about all of that today. So as you engage with those systems professionally, as well as many of you are identified as people of faith and are engaged in faith communities, you know, we are all engaged in medical systems. Think about what you might pay attention to as you leave here today to, you know, advocate some more inclusion in ways that maybe you didn't think or see before, but now you think or see. That would be my invitation to you all today. So how could you potentially be an agent of change? And sometimes agents of change wear tutus and march in pride parades. And sometimes agents of change notice there are two single stall restrooms that are gendered, and why not just degender them and make them both restrooms? That takes a screwdriver and two new signs. Right, you know, so you might be the person who is going to testify into your state legislature. You might be the person who just asks for a language change on an intake paperwork at an organization you work with that allows people just to write their identity, their gender, rather than have a two box check. You know, so there are small, there are big ways that we can help contribute to being agents of change. Okay, so I wanted to start by talking about some concerns for youth, and I'm going to go through a couple of different domains, and they're by no way comprehensive, but I'm kind of doing my best to talk about areas that we want to be thinking about and that you've already brought up is areas that you're already considering and that you're engaged in. So when we think about risks for LGBT youth, which are even higher for trans youth, there are higher rates of suicidality, higher rates of suicide, higher rates of substance abuse, alcohol abuse, higher rates of homelessness, higher rates of survival sex. We sometimes hear that be, you know, referred to as prostitution. I don't use the word prostitution. If a child is engaging in sexual acts, that is generally to survive, whether it be for food or for hormones or whatever it is that they feel like their needs are, the needs that they need to have a place to sleep. But all of these risk factors, much higher rates of dropout from school, less likelihood to go to college, less likely to get a job, less likely to maintain a job, more likely to be without housing, higher rates of homelessness as adults as well. The risk factors are just abysmal. And these are social issues. These are not because we have a group of bad people. These are because people are not treated justly and fairly in our culture. And it starts at very young ages. It starts in homes and it starts in schools. The reason that kids don't go to school, they skip school, the attrition rates or the dropout rates for trans kids are so high is because of their experience in their schools. It's not because they're not smart enough. You know, so many people can agree all children have a right to a safe education. But if at the same time we're not providing children a safe place to use the restroom, do they have access to a safe education? Do they have access to education at all? So I'll talk about this a little later, but I'll bring this up now. One of the moms that I interviewed in my study talked about her child who was, I want to say 8 or 9, I'm forgetting right now, but this child was not anorexic in that they had body image issues and didn't want to eat, but this was a child who would not eat anything or drink anything until 3 o'clock every day when they got home from school. They refused to eat or drink in the morning or at lunch because they did not have a safe place to use the restroom, and they were afraid to use the restroom at school. And if we think about what does that mean to a developing brain to be starved of nutrition and of water for that many hours in a day. You know, that has just stood out to me. I have included that in some of my testimony. I think it speaks really loudly as to how this child has figured out how to survive school at a very young age. But what are the consequences of that? And what can we do to change that experience? So anyway, I'll go back to the PowerPoint. So some of the areas that I want to focus on include a home environment. So are families being accepting? Are they rejecting? Are they less rejecting? I'll talk about some of the family acceptance research in a minute, but I mentioned this on Monday, that the risk factors for trans youth who and LGBT youth as a whole, but especially trans youth, whose parents are less rejecting. I didn't say accepting. I didn't even say halfway okay. Less rejecting. Their risk factors significantly decrease. So if parents can just figure out how not to say mean things to their child, even if they don't understand, those kids do better. Now, if parents can figure out how to love and embrace those children and support them, they do way, 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 way better. But there's even a difference. There's a significant difference between being outright rejecting and being less rejecting or just not rejecting. The bar is low, but that bar matters. We also have a big problem in foster care and group home settings. And I think this is a very relevant, we could have a whole session on this, as in, particularly in this place of faith and spirituality. Many people who choose to foster children do that because of the good they want to do in the world. Many of them are highly religious people. Many of them are not safe for trans youth. And so, we have children who are removed from their homes because their homes were not safe places. They may have experienced abuse or neglect. They get placed in a place, in a home that is supposed to be a safe haven, and that place is not safe either. And there aren't necessarily regulations or even screening to see. Now, if you have a social worker who's informed and is thinking, I have been contacted by social workers to talk about what they need to be paying attention to in order, you know, they have a trans youth and they want to make sure that they're placed appropriately. But it's not a requirement. And so there are some very unsafe situations for kids. You know, so here we are advocating for their safety and putting them in very, very unsafe situations, both in foster and group home settings. And some of the group home settings, they still separate by gender. And that gender is, in their eyes, determined really by sex. So they have the boys section and the girls section. And if you don't fit those two options, there's not really a place for you to go. And so they end up putting them in where their sex is assigned, which might not meet their identity, and that creates its own host of problems.
So do you mean that a particular foster family only takes girls or boys?
No.
Or their bedroom, I mean
a particular foster family who doesn't believe that transgender identities exist or are okay and treat that child poorly because they don't support them in their identity.
Okay.
And the scary part of that is sometimes those children are removed from their biological homes because they were rejected and treated very badly or abused. There are cases, and these are hard things to hear, it's hard things to say, but children whose parents think they can beat it out of them. It's horrific. And so a child who's been through that kind of trauma then placed into another environment that's not safe. And we already know the outcomes for kids in like foster system are not good. All across the board are not good. But then when we have an even further marginalized group.
So is it the case that that social worker either wouldn't have cared or wouldn't have found out, you know what I'm trying, or
well,
there was
sometimes
no other
they don't
place
know.
For him to go?
Sometimes,
yeah.
So
oh,
you know,
yeah.
A social worker might not have awareness or might not know.
Okay.
Sometimes the social workers might be highly conservative religious themselves.
Yeah.
And I know of cases where the social worker wanted to fix the child and intentionally put the child in a home that wasn't safe. You know, these are unfortunately the things that happen. So there are wonderful systems, there are wonderful agencies, wonderful social workers, wonderful homes that address and are inclusive. And there are places that are very, very scary that still exist. Actively exist. Reparative therapy efforts, while they are not something that most licensed clinicians could hang a shingle and say, hey, I practice this way, what we see now are mental health professionals, in quotes, who will volunteer with ex-gay ministries and will not call it therapy, but will call it ministry to try and fix people or correct their being gay or being trans. And so we have children who don't have the right to be on their own who end up in those types of environments as well. Those kinds of camps still exist. And we know that there is absolutely zero evidence that you can change somebody's sexual orientation or gender identity. The only evidence that exists from the overwhelming, repeated, rigorous social science research is that it ups risk factors. So there's no rigorous research that shows that it's beneficial. And in fact, when you look at the studies, they don't report attrition. They're not longevity. So to not do a longitudinal study on something that's supposed to be about change is kind of problematic. You're not following up to see if the change actually works. You really don't have evidence that it worked. But what we do have is evidence that it increases anxiety, increases depression, increases suicidality. And people do it, we're going to talk a lot about families. People do this because they oftentimes love their child. And it can be really scary for a parent who thinks and especially if they go to organizations like Focus on the Family, who says it's your job as the parent. You are responsible for your child's salvation. You got to fix this. Parents are desperate. They don't want their children's soul damned to hell. And I'm using harsh language because think about how scary that must be for parents. So I also don't want to demonize parents. Now, parents who hit their children, that's a whole other conversation. But in terms of parents who are rejecting of their child's identities, oftentimes it's fear and love, right? And they don't know what to do with that. And so as a therapist, I try to connect back to that ethic of love and think about how we might express that and do that differently. But it can be very scary, particularly from a religious perspective, if they believe that they won't get to spend eternity with their child, that they got to fix it here while they're here on earth, because this could be an eternity of damnation. That's scary stuff. I had a really good therapist who shared that with me about my own experience. And it was like, here I am again, all my training. And I was like, whoa, I hadn't thought about that. And now having that and talking with parents, it's so relevant. It's so incredibly relevant. It also has really helped with a trainer of therapists. It also helps therapists to be able to sit with parents who they really struggle with, parents who are maybe treating their kids in ways that they don't agree with. It's really easy to go, oh, they're a bad parent. And, you know, we want to complicate that and understand that experience so that we can work to change it. Because if we just demonize people, we're not making the situation any better for these children.
Kristen, I'm just sitting here thinking, I have a friend who's a retired psychiatric nurse, and there's a few in this room, and I've become friends with a woman who's a retired psychiatric nurse, and I just remember her saying over multiple times with questions and discussions I've had, no matter the question, love is the answer. And I mean, I'm just hearing that in love this child, learn to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that works.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
No matter the question, love is the answer.
And then, how do we love?
Mm-hmm. And how to, mm-hmm. you know, and there's many ways.
Yeah.
There's no one way.
And this is also a good place to consider where we get resources too. It's important that we are able to provide families, individuals, people who are interested in advocating or just understanding good, accurate science, scientific, you know, social science-based research. Because we hear things in our social conversations right now, like it's a choice, right? These kids are just rebelling. And there are what seems like resources online from organizations that are based in maybe ideology or seeped in politics, but not based in social science research, which would show, you know, how do we increase positive outcomes for kids.
I'll say one thing. Kristen provided several resources. They're all online. So if you go to our Holden website, Education This Week, in Kristen's name, there's probably 8 or 10 links that she has provided us, and we might do more. But
yeah,
I didn't want to forget that thing.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Credible resource.
Yes.
Okay.
If this is too off topic and you're going to cover it later, just feel free to tell me so. But I'm kind of like imagining some of this starts in schools and families, some of the feelings of rejection. And, you know, the school environment is administration, staff, teachers, but it's also a big part children. So what can parents and grandparents and mentors of children do to give them tools to make their school more welcoming? Is that, I mean, I don't...
Can you hold that?
Okay.
Let me click a few more times.
Okay.
And let's come back to that. Yeah, is that okay? Okay. So, and we could, gosh, really, any one of these domains that we're talking about, we could spend hours and hours talking
really?
About. So I'm going to move on,
okay.
Just for time's sake. So school environment is next. school environment includes the climate. What's the experience like? And climate includes children. It includes those children's parents. You want to know where the culprit is? It's the other kid's parents.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, where a kid goes home and tells their parent about, oh, my friend, and that parent says, oh, that's not right. Or, you know, your friend's going to hell. And then the kid comes back to school and says, my dad said you're going to hell. These things happen every day, all the time. I hear these stories constantly.
I teach first grade, and I've had first graders from, you know, different, not necessarily this particular thing, but, you know, some kid is different. I had a little boy that had long hair, and, you know, for half the school year, half my first graders think that he's a girl because, you know, he has long hair. And I did. I had a parent that I struggled with. If I could teach and just deal with my children, it would be
yeah.
You know, you bring right. parents. And I struggled with a parent who would come in constantly, I don't want my child playing with this particular child. Every time she'd come in, I'd say, I can't do that. You know, you can have these conversations at home, but I will not tell your child that they cannot play with another child. And, you know, and I told her that repeatedly, but it's true. It is the parents, and it's a struggle.
And I don't say this to be parent blaming. I think that children oftentimes will come in and reflect what they hear at home. So children themselves, if you took away those kinds of influences, especially when you've got the littles, they're kind of like, okay, really? You could wake up tomorrow and be a boy? Like, you know, I mean, developmentally, it's a possibility, right? Very egocentric. You know, they engage in a little magical thinking. It's a possibility. So as the kids grow and start to become more distressed by changes maybe not happening when they want them to, that we see some issues, but we also see issues when other kids come in and make judging statements that oftentimes come from home. And at the same time, there are so many kids that are just like, okay, cool, you want to play trucks? You want to play on the playground? I mean, oftentimes kids are the most resilient, welcoming, happy group who really don't come in with judgment until they're taught that. So climate matters. Like, what is the feeling in the school? And not just for the children, but for the parents as well. And that is oftentimes reflected in the kinds of policies the school system has. The research I'm going to talk about today, there's a whole nother part that we're not even going to go get to, which is specifically about school systems. Like, I have a whole set of data from these interviews that we ended up grouping parents' experiences into schools that kind of got it and had already done the work to make inclusive policy and have safe restrooms and didn't divide their kindergartners up by gender, and you know, they knew they were really working on being inclusive. There were schools that maybe didn't get it yet, but then once the parents started doing some advocacy, stepped back and said, okay, we need to make some changes. Let's work together to figure out so we can make improvement. And then there were the schools that were like, no, not happening. And it was really interesting to look at the difference in how those families were able to, the amount of time and energy that a mother with a child going to a non-inclusive school and the kind of work she had to do to take care of that child and to keep that child emotionally safe versus a parent whose child was going to a school who was really making an effort to get it. It took so much pressure and work off that parent and pressure and work off that family. They weren't having to advocate 24/7. I mean, so just the school environment makes a huge difference on the family experience. So how do policies reflect that? And the policies are oftentimes supported or not supported by administration. So a school board can have a policy that might be inclusive, but if the principal doesn't agree with it, then how are they implementing it in the actual school? Like, they might not violate the policy, but the implementation can look very different. So I was at the West Fargo School Board meeting about 2 years ago, and the superintendent got up and said in front of the school board, we have trans kids in our schools, we do everything we can to accommodate them. It was a very clear message, and it's one that he has repeatedly made. And so a couple months ago, when our current presidential administration rolled back the way that we were interpreting Title IX laws, so Title IX being gender equity, federal gender equity laws, have been under the Obama administration, were interpreted to protect gender identity as well. That would include things like restrooms. The current administration and Betsy DeVos and the Department of Justice and the Department of Education have decided not to interpret them as being inclusive to trans kids. So therefore, children do not have the option to use the restroom that reflects their identity, locker rooms, sports, all kinds of things. Those are federal level that then have consequence and influence on states, on districts, right? And how safe people feel. So what we did in Fargo is, in a matter of 2 days, I was a part of a group that put together a rally at our local Pride Center. And it ended up being, well over 100 people, standing room only, event that we didn't know. We thought, we'll just build it, see who comes. And the media was there, but we had contacted a couple of school board members, but then we had school board members that just showed up on their own. And they got up and spoke, and talked about school board policy and who to contact if you do experience discrimination, that this might be where, we are federally, but this is where our local community, this is North Dakota, right? This is North Dakota. Now, this rally would not have happened in other parts of North Dakota, I can assure you. But it was powerful that they did come and they did speak. So knowing where your school board members stand on these issues makes a huge difference as well in terms of how they're voting for policies and just what they're doing to improve climate. Them showing up at a rally isn't going to do anything regarding the policy, but it spoke really loudly to the families that were at the rally, to the children that were there. Like, we had some youth that got up and spoke about their experiences in the schools, and it was really powerful to hear them tell painful experiences and then have a school board member say, I want you to call me. This isn't okay. They might not have gotten the support they needed from maybe the teacher they went to, but here we have somebody who's like, you know, up the chain that's going to support them and try and figure out how to make this right. So, you know, these are just examples of how we can look at school environment. You know, what is, has a teacher ever had a conversation about these issues? And like I said, it's not required training, right? And then not only do we not require teachers to have training to understand the experiences of children, then they get the extra burden of then, like you were describing, other parents. How do we manage that? Like, talk about beyond your job scope. You know, to have to figure out how do you support the kids in front of you and then also address any backlash that might happen because you are potentially being supportive. You know, these are the kinds of issues that we're contending with all the time. So social, another area would be a social environment. So how are friends responding? Are there support groups for kids to attend in their local community? Do they have access? Is this particularly important when we consider like adolescent age kids? Do they have access to accurate information on identity? And then related, especially at that age, do they have access to accurate information on sex and sexuality? Because guess what sex ed doesn't include? LGBT sexuality in general, but certainly not transsexuality. And there are some really great curriculums. Our Whole Lives curriculum that was developed by the UCC and the Unitarian Universalist Church and the United Church of Christ is intentionally inclusive. LGBT inclusive, but also trans inclusive, because, you know, if we're only talking birds and bees and penetrative sex and pregnancy and STI avoidance, we're missing huge, I mean, think about the dynamic, I don't even have words right now, like everything that sexuality encompasses and how little resource, I mean, on a large scale, we provide young people very little resources to start with, but this group of students, these group of children, even less, right? And so what research shows overwhelmingly is that when kids have more access to accurate health information and accurate information and discussion around decision making, beyond just sexual avoidance and abstinence, but really the accurate health information and emotional health information, they're more likely to have less partners, they're more likely to delay sexual activity. And then when they do engage in sexual activity, they're more likely to engage in safer sex practices, and they're less likely to have multiple partners. So it's the opposite of people's fears. Like, we push abstinence-only education, which is just don't have sex till you're married, right? But there is no evidence of support, so that does anything. In fact, there's some research more recently that just came out that shows that children that engage in purity pledges are more likely to engage in sex within that year than kids who don't engage in purity pledges. I couldn't cite the study right now. I just recently read like a piece of it, so I'd have to go back and look, but it's not surprising. You know, it fits with other research that's been done in terms of, you know, are we teaching kids that their bodies are holy and sacred, and how do they honor that for themselves as well as the people whose bodies they're able to connect with? You know, how do they hold that sacred?
Just quickly, one way that I kind of do teaching with parents around that topic is I've often heard the analogy of, well, if you told your kid not to drive the car, why would you hand them the keys? And my answer to that is, I'm sorry, but your child already knows how to hotwire the car, so please teach them to wear a seatbelt.
Right. And what's important for trans youth especially is the relationship they have with their body is going to vary, you know? It's going to vary in lots of ways. So the language that a person might use to describe their body, if they don't feel feminine, they might not want to use feminine words. Words like vulva and breast aren't going to fit, maybe potentially not fit for them. Even though we could say, well, that's medically accurate. But we're talking about identity and experience. And, you know, being able to have preventative health care. So if you have a young person who identifies and presents masculine, that doesn't mean that they don't still need to have an annual exam, but it's the only place to get the annual exam at the women's clinic? Is there an exam room somewhere else? Who's going to make that ask? And if they do show up and they are coming with a masculine name, is the front desk staff going to make a derogatory comment? But why are you here? Like, these are things that happen as well. So we're thinking about, well, this social environment. Or I'll skip ahead. Medical care. All of these things, you know, they tie together, right? But these are concerns. So we know in young men, rates of testicular cancer are very high. If they don't know how to do a testicular cancer check and aren't getting checked at a doctor, they're going to be at higher risk. Yet, if they don't identify in a masculine way, they might not want to see a doctor. Or if they don't have a doctor who's going to honor the way they view their bodies or experience their bodies or experience their identity, they're less likely to go. And that's if they even have, you know, the insurance coverage and the access to getting medical care to start with. So there are lots of complications there. So, and I also think it's very important for us to consider both preventative care as well as gender-related care. So first and foremost, people need preventative care, right? They need a place to go to make sure that they are not at higher risk, and they need somewhere to go when they get strep throat, right? But going somewhere to get strep throat, if the physician or the nurse or the front desk check-in person is derogatory, transphobic, rude about their gender, the gender presentation, their gender identity, that person is less likely to receive preventative care. Right? So, I mean, it starts when you walk in the door of the medical facility. So do they have access, and then can they get preventative care? And then we can talk about gender-related care. Huge issues for young people, especially if they have rejecting parents. You can buy hormones on the internet that are not being regulated by a physician in terms of dosage. And, you know, something like testosterone is powerful stuff. It's so powerful, and it has such consequences for mood swings, for sex drive, you know, these are things that we want to see regulated, but they aren't always. So how do we support those kids? And something we talked about on Monday, or even like harm reduction efforts, like needle exchange programs, so that kids who are going to shoot their own hormones have a place to get a clean needle so that they're not reusing the one they've already used or using their friends. Because if they're desperate, they'll do what they need to do, which doesn't always mean making the safest choices for their health and other aspects of their health. So medical care is so incredibly important. This is also why I say, and this sometimes makes people's kind of hair go up, but I think that's okay. Organizations like Planned Parenthood have become far more trans inclusive than any other national health organization in the country. That's really important for us to consider, because we tend to have a microscope when it comes to that particular organization. But they, when it comes to LGBT health issues, they are really a great resource. So if you do have a medical clinic, lots of communities have medical clinics. Like my community does not have an abortion clinic that's related to Planned Parenthood. They have a medical clinic. They do preventative medicine, and they're doing preventative medicine for trans people, and it's low cost. So where your public health may or may not be inclusive, your Planned Parenthood office will be. So my job is not here to advocate for Planned Parenthood, but at the same time, I think it's important to have a takeaway resource that exists around the country to know. And then I just want to touch on our legal environment. I think we're all highly aware of that right now. I've touched on it a little bit. And that influences our social environment. You know, and this is, it's related, not the same, but we saw LGBT youth have lower rates of depression and suicide before marriage passed in states that had marriage equality compared to states that didn't. Because the climate in that state is different, right? The feeling of safety is different. So legal environments influence social environments. The kinds of issues that are coming up in states like North Carolina right now for young people, where their livelihood and their existence are being debated on a regular basis, for trans youth in terms of the bathroom bill that's on the table there right now, is very different from kids who are living in a place like Massachusetts, which has protections at the state level. Now, that's not to say that we don't have kids that are depressed and having a hard time in Massachusetts or that aren't thriving in North Carolina, but there are differences in terms of what is going on at the state level politically and how that then impacts families and individuals. We could probably go on about this for quite some time. So is there anything that anybody else wants to say about the legal environment
it's rapidly changing back and forth.
One other aspect of the legal environment is if you choose to have your birth certificate amended, you cannot do that in all states. So it's not even just a legal changing of your name, but if you wish to have the, it usually says gender marker, not sex marker, but if you want to have your birth certificate amended, you can do that in some states and not others.
Right. But you can have your federal passport changed in
yes.
all states.
Yes.
That did pass. Yes. So, again, you know, we're hardly, I'm realizing we have like 15 minutes left and there's so much more to say. So I'm just going to move ahead a bit. And I want to talk on this just really briefly. There's the report of the U.S. Trans Survey. This just took place in 2015. It was a follow-up to a survey that took place, I think, 2011. That survey had 6,500 participants, and that was the biggest trans survey, trans research data that we'd had to date. They did it again, 2,800 participants. Really phenomenal.
This is 28,000.
28,000 participants, excuse me, 28,000 participants that are trans-identified. That you know that we're willing to answer these surveys so that we can have a better sense of what is happening and how people are experiencing their discrimination as well as inclusion. And so what they found, and this is what I think is very relevant for us here today, is that 10% of those who were out to their immediate family reported violence by a family member due to their gender identity. Based on a gender identity, 8% of those folks that participated were kicked out of their homes. So really high numbers. 40% of the respondents had attempted suicide in their lifetime. That is nearly 9 times the suicide rate of non-trans people in the United States. 39% experienced serious psychological distress. That's compared to 5% of the U.S. population. 29% were living in poverty. If they were a person of color, those rates soared up to 38% to 40%. And that's compared to 14% of the general U.S. population. So when I say disparity, we're really talking about serious disparities. 15% unemployment rate, it's 20% if they were a person of color. So we're also seeing the intersection of marginalization when people are both trans and people of color. And that's also compared to 5%, so 4 times the rate for people of color. Than our general unemployment. There were some pluses. We found that 60% who were out to immediate family that they grew up with said that their family was generally supportive of their identity. 18% said their families were unsupportive. 22% said their family was neither supportive or unsupportive. So it seems like when it was bad, it was really bad. But there were more families that were generally supportive than not. And so that's hopeful. And here's a quote from the study that I thought was relevant. Those who said that their immediate families were supportive were less likely to report a variety of negative experiences related to economic stability and health, such as experiencing homelessness, attempting suicide, or experiencing serious psychological distress. So they themselves were also just able to say, because my family was supportive. You know, but again, the bar is really low, right? Like, we're not talking about thriving right now. We're literally talking about basic survival. Okay, so let's talk more specifically about trans and gender expansive kids and their family relationship. So these are a couple of different research studies that I can give you the full citations to. But the first are some of my colleagues at Jennifer McGuire and Russ Toomey and Stephen Russell, who found that transgender and gender creative children rely heavily on their home environments for acceptance, especially if they're receiving messages in other places that they don't that they don't belong. Home should be a safe haven. Now, what's different for trans kids, when we look at some of the research on how do you, as a parent, support a child so they feel, if they're a part of a marginalized group, feel less marginalized. And what's really interesting is if we compare that to the way that black families might socialize their children to deal with living in a racist culture, so home is still safe, right? Even if they treat you badly out there, you always belong here. That is not the case for trans kids and for many lesbian, gay, bisexual children as well. Sometimes home is the most dangerous place.
So they really rely heavily on home environments, and hopefully those home environments are going to be safe. The quality of their family relationships are highly correlated with their life satisfaction. And one of the most important factors in the lives of trans youth is the presence of an adult who's interested in their well-being and accepts them unconditionally. And this, that was from Caitlin Ryan's research, and that's one of the websites that Sharon was talking about, the Family Acceptance Project. I highly, highly recommend checking that website out. That is that data that I talked about being rejecting versus less rejecting. They are not a group of researchers that are only looking at the families who are doing it right. They are really trying to figure out what do we need to know to support families who really struggle with their kids' identities. They've created resources for teachers, for researchers, but also specifically for parents as well. So if you get the opportunity, I just highly recommend checking out their website. They have some publications that are geared towards parents in general, public, and then they have some research articles as well that are a little denser for folks, but some people want to see data in that way, so you can choose what kind of resources work best for you. Okay. We've talked some about child development, but kids in general get to know their own sense of their gender identity between ages 2 and 3. So it is not unusual for a child who is 3 years old to be expressing their gender in maybe a non-conforming or non-binary or creative way. We sometimes think, how does a little child know? Well, they might actually know. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to grow up to be trans, but it doesn't mean that they don't know what they're talking about either. And so when I've asked, all the research I do, I always ask parents, what's the best advice you can give to other families? And they always say, listen to your children. Almost like, they almost direct quote, like say, listen to your kid, let the kid lead, pay attention, believe them. So these are from parents who have lived this. And we've talked about some of this. So I'm gonna skip ahead. Okay. We find that youth are disclosing at younger ages. So there are some pros and some cons. That offers more opportunities for families to start supporting those kids at younger ages, for communities to be providing support for those children, and at the same time, it increases their risk for victimization, both in their family and in their social environment. So depending on how the response is, it can be really positive or it can be really problematic. Okay, and I can maybe post this somewhere. This is a chart that comes, it's put together by several different several different publications and research publications around supportive versus harmful responses from families. And so I want to pay attention to supportive, like what do the parents do that are doing it right, that are supporting their children, their kids are doing better. They tend to work on negotiating the difference between parent beliefs. So if there's more than one parent in the household, parents don't always agree. I know of families, parents who have divorced over this. I am consulting with a family right now where the father is suing the mother for full custody with allegations that the mother is being neglectful because she's allowing the child to express their gender in the way the child feels fits who they are. And it is actively, that case is actively happening right now. It can be quite challenging between two people, whether they still be in a relationship together or if they're divorced or separated or were never married. But that's something that I love that that's first on the list, because that's really important. That if a parent is struggling, it doesn't mean the parents don't struggle. It's where the struggle happens. The struggle should not happen in front of the child or other children in the home. The struggle happens in the bedroom with the other parent or with a friend or with a therapist. The struggle doesn't happen in front of the child. And so that's a really important response. But they require respect from other family members. So if grandpa can't honor the identity of this child, they will stand up or they might limit contact. If an aunt or an uncle or a cousin, they may or may not allow that child, maybe they won't cut off contact, but they won't allow that child to be alone with that person so they can be there to monitor the conversation and how things go. These are the kinds of things that they do. They support their gender expression. They disregard gender stereotypes. They advocate for that child's safety, both in medical care and school systems. They provide open communication. They seek community for their family. That's really important.
through siblings to be able to know the sibling of another kid. So if you have a family with a trans child, is there another family with a trans child who also has a big sister who's trying to figure this out? Can those two kids spend time together? That is why there are camps that now take place around the country, Gender Odyssey, the Philadelphia Children's, there's several, where they offer family camp. And so in those camps, they'll often offer sessions for dads, specifically, you know, dads of trans girls, which if we think about the way we socialize masculinity, that can be really challenging for dads. And so having a place for dads to get together to talk about their struggles with other men who are dealing with similar struggles can be quite powerful. Now, these aren't happening as frequently as I would like to see them happening, but they do exist. That's where it's important to know resources like Trans Youth Family Allies, whose website's been down lately, so I need to see if it's working again. They're kind of like a clearinghouse organization. They know all the organizations all over the country. They were very helpful to me in recruiting folks to take place in interviews with me because they are connected. But their website, when it's up and running, also provides really useful and helpful resources for families, for teachers, for general public. And then just in honoring the child, using the name that they're interested in, that fits for them, and using the pronoun that reflects their gender. I'm paying attention to time. And I'm just now at my study. So I'll just briefly go over, there's several slides and we don't need to go through all of them. I was really important. No, I'm not. I was really interested in the experiences of parents of primary caregivers. Part of the reason is that the data that does exist and the resources that exist in regards to trans kids tends to be reflective from trans adults. So an interviewer will survey or go out and ask questions of an identified trans person or gender expansive person to talk about their experiences of childhood in a reflective way. We oftentimes don't have anything that comes from family members or loved ones, and we don't have data that comes from the kids themselves. So I was really interested in talking about parents. As we know, the home environment is this really critical place for children to thrive or children to experience rejection. So what's going on in families and how are families dealing with this? And so what I found in a nutshell, so without going through all the slides, kind of nutshell what I found is that oftentimes parents, first of all, because of the nature of my study, I didn't have families respond that are struggling with their parent, their kids' identities. And if they were struggling, they weren't struggling in terms of rejection, they were struggling with other social issues, you know, or navigating systems. So, because I'm very clear as a researcher that the reason I'm asking these questions is because I want to train therapists better so that we can provide better support. So I'm very transparent in that. Generally though, if somebody is struggling with their child's identity, they're not going to want to talk to a researcher about it. So I just want to be transparent about that up front. So the folks that responded were people who have come to a place of supporting their child. I did not recruit mothers, I recruited parents, but everybody I spoke to was a mother. Interestingly, we can talk about gender a whole another day in terms of caretaking. I did have one dad who made the phone call initially, but then his wife ended up doing the interview, and there was one family where the couple were both, it was a phone interview, and the couple were both on the phone. So there was a mom and a dad. But he's the only dad that participated in the interviews, and that was with his wife. So that was interesting on a study about gender. So we see, you know, just an unexpected finding was moms are really taking on the primary responsibility in terms of doing the advocacy work for their kids. And oftentimes they've maybe heard of transgender or gender identity, but they didn't really know what it meant. They didn't know what to look like in their own family. And so they get online. Almost all of them would get online and look for information. So this is where that having access to accurate information is so incredibly important. And then they would connect with either a physician or a therapist or a support group. And that support group might be 4 hours away. Just looking for any kind of information to really understand what's going on with their child. And then once they were connected, they would get connected with different kinds of supports. And where they relied on the most information was other families. So the number one source of support for these families were other families who'd been through the situation before that had a child that was somewhat like their child in terms of their gender identity.
And so they would rely on those families, and eventually they would kind of transform into being the support system for other families. They would get more involved in those organizations. And as they realized what was going on, there was an awareness in many of them, a growing awareness of discrimination. The families that participated in my project were primarily middle-class, educated white families. Now, when I do my next project, I'm going to intentionally kind of address that, because I believe in having racial diversity and understanding the experiences of people who live in poverty as well as people who are living in, you know, affluent, kind of more wealthy situations with access to resources. But for this project, that is who I talked to. So these were people that had insurance, you know, that whose kids were going to safe schools, a lot of them, you know, in suburban areas, and they were from all over the country. But they found that finding other families who had been through the same thing was the most helpful. Then they came into these roles where they were providing the support for other families. And then many of them started doing advocacy work themselves. One of them started a, there wasn't like a church camp for kids that were trans, so they started, I think they were Lutheran. They started a Lutheran kids camp that was inclusive to LGBT kids intentionally in their local community. Some of them started, developed school board trainings and trainings for the teachers in their kids' schools, and like developed a curriculum so that the school now had that and is using that. Other parents started doing things like meeting with legislators to draft inclusive legislation, or going and lobbying legislators at the state level. One of them, it was involved in as we were talking, I recognized the story and I realized this is somebody who had taken their story very public, and I already knew the story because I'd read about it in the media. So these are families that felt like, now that I've realized what we've gone through, and realize the kinds of concerns that children have, we feel like it's our ethical obligation to be talking about this, to be educating, to be supportive, to be creating new support systems for both these children and these families so that they can do better, because what we have going on right now just isn't enough. So that's the project in a nutshell. We are out of time. We're over time, so I want to stop. And are there any questions or comments? I'm really sorry that I didn't manage the time as well as I would have liked to. So I'd like questions, comments, but then I also want to invite you, there's a word up here from Love from Monday. What I want to ask you to do is, I would love to have some kind of visual representation. If you would just think of a word or a phrase of hope for children, and kind of share that on your way out. If there are ideas or thoughts you have as a result of our conversation today, I would really love for you to put it on that piece of paper up at the front on your way out. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? Sorry, I feel like we're abruptly ending.
You have like a list of children's books or books you recommend for families to read with children?
Yes, there are some that are on the website, the Holden website. Are you thinking like books for parents about kids, or like kids books?
Kids books.
There are some great kids books. I do not have those.
Okay.
Remind me. I'm afraid I'm going to forget. Okay. So let's figure out how to remind me, because I will add those. Because there are some wonderful children's books that also address gender creativity, that they're not just trans.
Yeah.
Kind of, but like My Princess Boy was written by a mother whose little boy likes to wear princess dresses. He's not trans. But they got all kinds of backlash in their community, and she decided there's nothing really for my child, so she wrote this book. So there's some really great resources like that too.
One thing I was thinking of when we were talking about schools, if a child has a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, are they then eligible for a 504 or an IEP to get their needs met?
Don't know.
Because I was wondering if that was like maybe a way around the Title IX thing, because it would be,
that's a good question.
Medical.
That's a good question. I don't know.
Probably, and I wonder if it's all in like the 504 or something.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If it's technically a medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria, it doesn't matter how you interpret Title IX, because they have a medical diagnosis.
It makes sense, but I don't. That's a great question. I have not heard of that happening. But
it just popped into my head as we were talking
right.
about this.
And the part that gets a little challenging is that lots of gender creative and trans kids don't have gender dysphoria. So, you know, a kid who actually experiences distress might qualify, so that, which I think is a good lead-in.
But
so, yeah.
The 504, because the difference between the 504 and IEP is that IEP has to have, like, significant documentation, I think, behind it, where 504 is just, what do we need to do to accommodate your child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or keep going.
Well,
you can carry it, carry it to college at least.
It can. I mean, my child with ADHD had a 504 for 4 or 5 years, and we finally converted it to an IEP.
I think a 504 would be like a stepping stone to a more like official.
So the place you could probably find answers to this would be Trans Youth Equality Foundation or GLSEN.
Yeah, I'm involved with our GLSEN.
Okay.
Yeah.
So their national organization might be able to provide more. I don't know.
But yeah, it just popped into my head.
Yeah, that was a great question. It's a really great question.
I'm always looking for a way to go in the back door.
No, that's great. Well, that's what you have to do, right? I mean, that's you do what you got to do in order to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that your file out there?
Yeah, Sam's got her.
Okay.
Well, good.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
As you were talking about the sex ed stuff, the Elizabeth Smart story popped into my head because I know she talked so much about her situation and being raised LDS and being taught certain things about, you know, about sex and about your body and that kind of stuff, how shame she felt mm-hmm. by being in her situation and being raped, and how that teaching of what she learned caused so much shame for something, and I know it's kind of different, but it made me think about the not talking about it, how those kids would feel, automatically feel shame, like I'm,
mm-hmm.
like you don't even want to talk about the things that I'm feeling, so obviously you're ashamed of me, and it kind of, you know, that's for those conversations.
Yeah.
And
we could do a whole, like, week-long session on sex ed.
Yeah. I wanted to just share something in parent education that I had. Made me think about when you were talking about the schools, Kristen. She was advocating for parent involvement and, you know, so on in the schools. And as she was speaking in this forum in Minnesota, she was a parent educator from there, she said, all of a sudden this man said, oh, you're talking about the third rail. And she said, the third rail, what's that? Believe it or not, it's a railroad term. It's a train term. There's three rails. And when the two are engaged, nothing's going to happen. But when that third rail is engaged, the train moves. And I think of that as an analogy with the parent involvement or the energy that has to come from somewhere out to bring that. I just think I was thinking about that analogy as you were talking about that earlier. But I'm not describing the third rail very well, but just Google third rail.
I will do that.
You know, I mean, I just think there's maybe a metaphor there.
Well, I do love metaphors, so I will look.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Kristen.
Thank you.